Folks, a programming note before we begin. The Perfect Wave will be an audio documentary told in 6 major parts. To support this project and its production costs, I'm going to try something new, an app called Storyboard. Here's how it works. Using the app, iPhone users can become power listeners of the show for $2.99 for 4 weeks. In exchange, you're going to unlock 3 bonus perks. First, you'll get all major episodes a week early, starting with episode 2. You'll be the first to hear them. Second, I'm going to make a minimum of 2 bonus episodes just for the power listeners to break the story down even further. And wait, there's more, because third, you're going to get a Fear the Wave sticker shipped to you as a token of appreciation. Now, if you're not an iPhone user or this isn't for you, don't worry. All major episodes will be available on your podcast app of choice. But if you want to go even deeper, go to the App Store, search for Storyboard Podcasts, and become a power listener today. Now, let's roll into the show. This is a presentation of FearTheWave.com, and I'm your host, JP Gooderham. This show will document one of the most shocking turnarounds in college football history, the undefeated 1998 Tulane Green Wave. Episode by episode, 20 years after the fact, we'll figure out what it took to turn a struggling college football program into a true national powerhouse. There is no major spoiler to the show. We know that this team will finish the 1998 season a perfect and record-breaking 12-0. But what did it take for Tulane to get there? This is their story, and this is the Perfect Wave. This is Chapter 1, From Buddy to Bowden.
Another Saturday, another loss for Tulane. Though the players try hard, reporters covering the games continue to search for new ways to talk about another disappointing, non-competitive loss. Tulane's players and coaches don't help much as they pull out the stock answers. We're playing hard, we're young, and it's just a matter of execution. Last night's 38-0 loss to an average Ole Miss team was another yawner in a season of sleep-inducing games.
We're a well-kept secret. We're a better football team than anyone knows. And the key is we have one game left to show it.
There's no arguing with the secret part. Tulane's been playing basically in private during its games in the Superdome. Mercifully, last night's game was over less than 5 minutes in. The final 55 minutes was an exercise in futility. Tulane's quarterback spent a large part of the evening on their backs. When they got passes off, they were mostly off the mark. And when they hit their mark, they were dropped.
It seemed like we were allergic to the football tonight. It bounced away from us. We dropped it and let it escape.
However, no amount of embarrassing losses will get head coach Buddy Tevens to admit this team is moving backwards.
I don't believe we're losing ground. Certainly, we are human. There is frustration, and as hard as we push mentally, guys do, it wears on them a little bit.
Now, before I get rolling, I should probably say why I'm working on this project in the first place. And the best way I could explain it is this. As a blogger and podcaster, I started covering the Green Wave in 2012 while I was still in my undergrad years. But throughout my time following the program, I've always been struck by how important the 98 season is in the minds of Green Wave fans. While I'm recording this, we stand just a couple months away from the 20th anniversary of a season that, honestly, feels like a legend at this point. And that's not just because of the momentous accomplishment of the team. For younger Tulane fans, that year almost feels like a myth. Since 1998, I think that's because the Green Wave has faced pretty much everything that a program on the edge can face. From a departmental review that questioned whether there should even be a football program in Uptown, or you can look at Katrina threatening to wash the Wave out of existence, or even just the many losing seasons in a near empty Superdome that the Wave went through. Brutal. It's for that reason that I decided to take a look at the 1998 team as my summer project, to move beyond the myths and the legends. I wanted to get the real story, and that meant figuring out what it really takes to build a winner in New Orleans against all odds. And that also means to go somewhere that almost every single Tulane coach has tried and failed to achieve. As many of you probably know, though, the story of the undefeated Tulane Green Wave starts in part when a son of a famous coaching family comes to Uptown with an ambitious goal. But we'd miss something important if we started only right there. In the 1990s, as WWL so bluntly pointed out at the top of the show, things were most certainly sliding backward for the Green Wave. The last time Tulane had produced a winning season of any sort was 1980 under Vince Gipson, when the team went 7-5. Even worse, the team, for the most part, wasn't even competitive during this drought, winning only 1 or 2 games in an entire season, a brutal 6 times over that stretch. Even Mack Brown, who's being inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame this year for giving Texas its first national title in 30 seasons, never fully cracked the code at Tulane. His best team did, in fairness to him, go 6-6 before he bolted for the job at North Carolina. And all of this is to say one overwhelming fact. Tulane just flat out wasn't a good football program when we find them in the mid-90s. The keys were then handed over to Coach Buddy Tevens, who had earlier revitalized Dartmouth. He came to New Orleans with the hopes of reviving another green-clad team that was mired in a swamp of losses. But by 1996, that vision was quickly proven to be nothing more than a mirage. Tevens would accrue a disastrous record of 11-45 in his 5 years with the Green Wave, finishing on a sour 2-9 note before becoming just another Green Wave coach to unceremoniously exit the picture. To be fair, while Tevens struggled to find success on the field, the players I spoke with consistently gave him credit, as his leadership was a big reason they still chose Tulane in the end, even while being recruited by other schools. I asked Brad Palazzo, a place kicker from 1995 to 1998, how he saw the program develop, as his career spanned both coaching staffs. One more thing I should note, though. I should say that Brad ultimately would go on to be a professional kicker, first with the Saints, but later with a fledgling league known as the XFL. Just a fun fact. Here's what Brad had to say.
Well, it was night and day. It really was. You know, you got to be careful when you say that, because Buddy Tevens recruited me out of high school, okay? I mean, he gave me my shot to play Division I football. Great staff. We had a lot of talent on that team, but a complete different, when I say night and day, I mean, it was a complete shift in paradigm from the way that that staff did everything. I mean, the way they meeted, the way they met with their players, the way they conducted dinners, the way they conducted on-field sessions of practices, the way they conducted off-season workouts. It was just completely different. It was a great experience with Coach Tevens and that staff. It was just challenging, man. I mean, I think, what did we win? My freshman and sophomore year, I believe we won 3 games, if memory serves me correct.
As Brad points out, there were quality players on Coach Tevens' roster. And after Tevens' firing, athletic director Sandy Barber would recruit a coach to replace him at Tulane, who brought a family name that's even associated with success in big-time football. And that was Tommy Bowden. Coach Bowden, whose dad dominated as head coach at Florida State, was at the time serving as Auburn's offensive coordinator, where his brother Terry was head coach. I wanted to know why exactly Coach Bowden chose Tulane for a shot at leading a program. I caught up with Coach Bowden while he was driving, and I wondered if he knew the potential of the team, like the future second-round draft pick and quarterback Sean King was already there, among others, waiting to be developed. Here's what he said.
We were going to run the system at that particular time, regardless of the personnel. Now, I didn't know anything about Sean. Some head coaches, during the interview process, they watch a bunch of tape before they take the job. I never did that. I'll just take what we had, and I was going to run the system. We put that in not knowing the wide receivers. Buddy Tevens, the head coach before me, had really done a good job recruiting. Sean King was there. We had some really good wide receivers and running backs. The offensive line had it, but you can work around the offensive line with that type of offense. As long as you score points, you can get away with, you know, just kind of playing fairly good on defense. Now, I do remember specifically after spring ball, we went through spring ball and it was to get after cold blooded, trying to introduce this offense. Nobody was really buried it yet in Division 1A. I remember after, gosh, right there toward the end, walking off the practice field one day, I think it was a Saturday scrimmage, Rich Rodriguez turned to me and he said, I don't know if we can do this or not. I don't know if it's going to work.
So I'll make a side note here. Coach Bowden is breaking down his offensive coordinator, Rich Rodriguez, a guy who's known now as an offensive mastermind, as he'd later go on, after engineering success at Tulane, to become the head coach at schools like West Virginia, Michigan, and Arizona. But a lot more to come on that later. At this point in the story, Coach Bowden knew he wanted to run Rich Rod's system, building a fast, spread-oriented team that could push the limits of its Conference USA competition. Coach Rodriguez, better known throughout football as Rich Rod, was at the time not a coach who had taken teams to BCS bowl games or developed dual threat superstars like West Virginia's Pat White. Because in 1997, Rich Rod was the head coach of a D2 school up in West Virginia, running a quirky offense that played out of the shotgun instead of under center and called plays without a huddle. Here's Rich Rod on his background. So coach, you know, I talked to Coach Bowden. He said that he first got linked up to you. I think you might have worked at a camp that he and his brother were running. How did you catch on to that staff and end up at Tulane in the first place?
I was a head coach at a small college, Glenville State College in West Virginia. And one of my good friends was Jimbo Fisher, who's from West Virginia and I've known since high school, but was on the staff with Terry Bowden at Auburn. And every year they'd have a summer camp for quarterbacks and receivers. And Jimbo got me down to work it. And I'd drive down just to work it just for recruiting because there'd be 300-400 kids there. So I got to know Tommy because he was on the staff as well. And for 4 or 5 years, I worked their camp, but I'd never worked with him. And so when he called me about going to Tulane, I was the head coach and athletic director at Glenville State. We were doing well, had played for the national championship. But I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't even know, wasn't sure where Tulane was at the time. And he said, it's in New Orleans. And I said, now that might be good. And he said, I'll offer you the offensive coordinator's job. And I said, Tommy, I know that you're an offensive guy. That sounds great. And it's a chance to go Division I, but I only know this offense. And he said, that's what I'm hiring you for. You run your offense. And so I thought, wow, I know it. What a great opportunity. I had worked at the Division II level, but you always have like a little bit of doubt while working at the big school level. And Tommy and the offensive staff were all in with it. And it was ugly the first spring, but boy, it took off after that.
So now what we're seeing is that the staff was determined to produce something different at Tulane. And Coach Bowden, he was the kind of guy who would take a big swing if it could mean a home run, even though there might be costs. But changing a culture was not something that was just going to happen overnight in Uptown. Offensive lineman Jimmy Ordino, a junior going into 1997, remembers this wake-up call when Coach Bowden arrived and players saw for the first time how they were going to be tested.
The intensity level ramped up, and really it started before camp, that spring semester before the 97 season. They showed up, and I mean, they were very blunt. They were going to win, and they were going to recruit the guys that could get them there. And they were willing to give us a chance, but if we weren't going to be the guys that got them to winning, and frankly, we were a bunch of losers up to that point, then we would be replaced. And it was a very intense, very physical opportunity. You know, Coach Stevens did all of sort of the same beats throughout the off season, but everything was just a lot more intense. I mean, to give you an example, I mean, we did the morning mat drills under Coach Stevens, and it was, you know, 6 a.m. drills and coaches screaming and doing all this stuff. They were 45 minutes long. It took forever, and they were hard. They were difficult, but Coach Bowden's mat drill was, you know, 6 a.m., but, you know, it was only about 30 minutes, but it was twice as hard. Just from the mental challenge and the physical challenge that you were being presented with. Then we go into spring drills, everybody's job's on the line. And, you know, he actually made the call to take the red jerseys off of all the quarterbacks. The quarterbacks were alive that spring. He could tell, looking back, you know, he could tell that Sean King was the guy with amazing talent. But there was questions, I guess, that he had whether he was tough enough or the right guy to lead the program. So he was going to find out. And Sean and Xavier Salazar and Jeff Curtis, our quarterbacks at the time, I mean, none of them wore the red jerseys. You know, they were live. They were hit by the defensive linemen because us offensive linemen, we weren't that good. And we weren't blocking very well. And our quarterbacks got killed all spring. But, you know, to all of their credits, you know, all of those guys just kept getting up and taking the next rep. And so I think collectively, you know, particularly from the important positions like quarterback, I think we showed them that we were willing to do what it took to be better. And maybe we weren't the greatest group of athletes ever assembled, but, you know, we were willing to do what was necessary. And I think that those guys, meaning the coaching staff, they figured they could work with that. And it looks like they could have.
This was something that I heard consistently in my interviews, that many players in the team were able to rise to the occasion. They were desperate to win after years of losing, and they finally saw an opportunity to climb out of the cellar. Fellow offensive lineman Bernard Robertson, who I should note would later go on to an NFL career out of Tulane, he saw that the bar was being raised by the new staff, and the reality was that some players wouldn't be able to cut it.
Those guys who were comfortable got a jolt. That camp that we had the year that Bowden came in, it was tough. It was one where we had guys, before we even stepped foot onto St. Paul's campus, we had some guys that quit because they were pushed so hard that summer. We had some guys that made it through the first couple of days and then they walked off the field. And we had some guys that were asked to leave by teammates because they just weren't going to commit or put in the work that was being asked of them. And so we had a lot of guys, and as Coach Bond would always say, I don't need to get rid of anybody. The work and the team will get rid of everyone that doesn't want to make that sacrifice. It was true. Those of us that wanted to win, those of us that wanted to be in a bowl game, sit on top of the hill, so to speak, we're going to put in the work and drive off anybody that was going to slow us down. And that's exactly what happened.
Now, this is a crossroads for the team, because if you put yourself in the shoes of those players and coaches, you have to think they may have felt like they were on some pretty shaky ground. On the player side, for instance, they were confronting a completely new staff, one with high expectations, and certainly one that didn't recruit them to the school. They knew only a legacy of losses during their Wave careers, and yet, they're being expected to commit fully to a new program and a new system. And for the coaches, they held ambitions not just to win, but to do something radically different from other programs. And that was building an up-tempo team that would philosophically challenge what everyone else was doing in college football. If it were me, I'd wonder if we were in some serious trouble. And apparently I wasn't alone. Here's what Richrod thought at the time. According to Coach Bowden, he took the job without watching any tape. I mean, I don't know if you knew the players coming in, but you're coming in with a system that really no one at the FBS level was running. Can you tell me when you, maybe that was watching tape or maybe watching spring ball, I'm talking about 97 now, did you think you could do it? Or was there a moment of, hey, man, maybe we bit off more than we can chew? What was that like?
Oh, man. Yeah, there was a lot of those moments that first spring. I didn't know who was on the team, didn't know anything about Sean King or any of the players. But we knew it was going to be a complete shock to them, not just the different schemes, but the tempo and how we're going to go about doing it. And I try to probably forget it, but I think in this first spring game, Sean King probably got sacked like a dozen times. If there are records for spring game sacks, we'd have said it because it was just ugly. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a disaster. I left a comfortable job and, you know, we're not going to make it through three games. And I thought that way all the way through the summer. But to Tommy's credit, Tommy's like, hey, it's new. These guys will get it. Just keep plugging along. And Tommy had a lot more confidence in it than I did at the time. And then even during fall camp, it was the same way. Like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And in the first game, I think it was Cincinnati or somebody, didn't start off the best. And I'm like, oh my gosh. But Tommy never wavered. He said, just keep doing it. Keep plugging along. And it kind of turned in that game, that first game, and we won. And then it just kind of took off. The players really bought in. I don't know if there's ever been a hungrier group of guys to work and prove themselves and buy into it that first year at Tulane. And that made the whole difference in it. I thought that just the way they bought in.
With Coach Bowden's confidence remaining intact and players rising above their past to meet his and the staff's expectations, things felt like they were starting to change in the fall camp of 1997, even though this team was just a year removed from a 2-9 season.
I think when Coach Bowden came in, there was such a want-to from the members there that we just wanted to win, just tired of the same old thing. So when that happened, we were able just to get a new coach in, you know, with the name of Bowden. It just sounded right, and all sounded right in the name of football. And when he came in, people got renewed about what we were there to do. I mean, yeah, we all are there for the student-athlete process, and I know Tulane and other places, you know, they have to throw a main part, which is that we're there to get an education, and I get that, and I can appreciate that. But we're also there to play ball as well.
That's Jerry Godfrey, offensive lineman. The players were not going to back down, and the team was only looking forward. They were desperate for victory, and for the first time, they felt they might actually be able to get there. For many new coaches, that first season, it's considered something of a year zero, meaning that epic failures or mediocre results are not really held against the coach. They don't have their guys in the system, after all, and they might need more time to make it happen. So how did things look with all of this change in 1997, the first year of Green Wave football under Tommy Bowden? We know Coach Rod was nervous about what the results might look like, so let's see what actually happened once the team stepped foot on the field. As 1997 opened, Tulane took on a challenging opening schedule. In our interviews, many players pointed to a trip to Syracuse as a turning point for the team. That was the third week of the season. And you see, Syracuse at the time was absolutely stacked. Built around a star quarterback who would go on to the Pro Football Hall of Fame by the name of Donovan McNabb.
The one that stands out to me was the Syracuse game up in the Carrier Dome. My junior year, I mean, we basically won the game, you know? I mean, you've got Donovan McNabb and Tabucky Jones. Those are two names that stand out that were on that Syracuse team. But we go up there. I believe we're 2-2 at the time, maybe even worse. I don't know. I don't remember what our record was. It was early in the season. And we beat them. We beat them up and down the field, period. Should have won the game. I think we had a turnover in the wee minutes of the game down in their territory that they returned for a touchdown. But I specifically remember that game, our locker room really turning after the Syracuse game. I believe there were a lot of people that just didn't accept losing anymore. And to me personally, that particular game was a turning point to where we were pretty hard to beat after that game, that Syracuse game up there in New York.
That was kicker Brad Palazzo. But what did he mean that the team couldn't accept losing anymore? That's the kind of thing you often hear a coach say after a tough game, and I wanted to understand how a team really internalizes that idea, how it becomes part of your program and the way you think. So let's take a look at this specific game and its aftermath. In this matchup, Tulane puts the Orange Men, loaded with talent as they were, on upset alert. The Green Wave had forced four first half interceptions, and the Orange rallied in the second half for a 30-19 win. But the Wave actually had a chance to steal it on the final play, which was returned for a touchdown. With a chance to beat a highly regarded team in the bag, it was very easy for this to seem like a moral victory, the kind of moment for a young team that coaches often sell as a stepping stone to future greatness. This was absolutely not the path that Coach Bowden and his staff chose, as Jimmy Ordino explains. Let me hit you with an outsider perspective, and I want to see if I'm onto something. Looking at that 97 season, I think it's the third or fourth game of the year, you guys go up to Syracuse and play Donovan McNabb, and probably should have won that game, right? Doesn't go your way. Cuse comes back in and wins it. But then, from that point on, you never had a losing record again under Coach Bowden. I think there were three straight wins by double digits or more after that. Did it feel like a turning point at all where things started to click? How did you see that 97 season progress?
Yeah, that was basically it. A lot of us talk and kind of point to that. The initial pop was coming out of the gate and beating Cincinnati comfortably. They were supposed to beat us. We were probably double-digit underdogs, and they beat us comfortably. Then we stumbled and lost to Rice, you know, in a game we should have never lost at home. But then we went to Syracuse. You know, that was a team that took the national champion Tennessee team the very next season with McNabb and all those guys still back. That was the closest game that they played all year. And we had no business playing with that team, and yet we went to their place. Really, it came down to the last play of the game. And, you know, we had a chance to win it from the 5-yard line. We lose the game. I remember getting home that night, you know, feeling pretty good about ourselves, despite everything we had been through and the toughening up and all that. We got off the plane in Syracuse. I remember going to the boot and the game is being replayed on ESPN2. And I'm kind of watching our game again, watching. It's like, you know what? We did a pretty good job. I mean, it hurt that we lost, but, you know, we kind of represented ourselves well. You know, that's what I was feeling. Well, we showed up for film the next day, and I've never in my life been involved with such a tirade of being ripped and just, you know, it was an aggressive coach. I don't mean it derogatorily to the coach, but I mean, they got after us, and they pointed out in blunt detail how we blew that game and how that was unacceptable. So, you know, think about the mindset, you know, the 2-9 mindset that we had going in is like, man, we played really close against a really great team. You should be proud of that. And then these guys, their expectations were much higher. It's like, that's not nearly enough. Who cares that you came close? The problem is you didn't win, and you should have won. It was a very difficult week of practice, but then we came on the heels of that, and we went to Louisville, and we put up 64 points in their building. That was where the 98 season was born, was from that understanding that close ain't good enough. You know, looking good is not good enough. You need to win, and win, and win, and win, and that sort of started that next week.
I asked Rich Rod at what point during the season did he start to feel comfortable in his system. He brought up the Syracuse game as a major point for the team, a time when they would have to learn how you gain what he calls true confidence. Coach, when did you get comfortable? We talked about how at the onset, you didn't know if this was going to work at the major college level, which is crazy to think about because this is the paradigm of how college football is today. Was it in the 97 season? Was it after the Syracuse game? Did you have a moment where you're like, okay, this is going to work?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if I've ever been comfortable in 30 years, but you get more confident. It was probably in the first few games in the first year. I remember the Syracuse game because we're going up there and we had a chance to win and we didn't win. And I still get teased about it from the players about the film session afterwards where everybody thought, well, you know, we played close against a really good team on the road. And I thought our guys were too satisfied with playing close. And so we had a very interesting, let's put it that way, team offensive meeting after that game saying, hey, listen, we should have won that game. Now, even though you guys got a little confidence on that, the end is not to get confidence. The end is to win the game. And so as the season went along, we could see our guys, you know, their confidence growing in themselves and their abilities because they were good players. We were lucky. They, you know, Sean King and we had a lot of talented guys. They just weren't playing with a lot of confidence, and the confidence that some of them tried to show early was false confidence. It wasn't the true type of confidence you get from working at a different level. And as the season went along, they started getting what I call the true confidence, the real confidence that they need to have.
The team wouldn't settle for a 1-2 start, and it galvanized an explosion in the offense. The results were obvious on the field. The Green Wave responded by rattling off 3 consecutive victories over Army by a score of 40-0, Louisville by 64-33, and East Carolina by 33-16. These were the kind of numbers that would have sounded like a joke in reference to Tulane just 12 months before. And Tulane, most importantly, would never flirt again with a losing record under Tommy Bowden. The Wave would complete the season with a 7-4 record to break a streak of losing seasons. I talked to Ed Daniels, who has covered Tulane football as a sportscaster and writer in New Orleans for over 30 years, and he remembers how much of a paradigm shift was happening in the Superdome on Saturdays.
They were in the throes of a long losing streak. And the one thing that these guys did is they instantly made Tulane football winning and fun. And it was an amazing story to watch these guys not only beat people, but literally run them out of the stadium offensively. The defense knew, hey, if we hold the other team to 25, we're going to win because no one can stop our offense on a consistent basis. So basically, if there were 10 or 11 possessions in a game or whatever it was, that's all the defense had to do was get stops on 6 or 7 of them because they knew that the offense wasn't going to be held down. They knew that they were going to score. They knew that they were going to move the football. And there was tremendous pressure on the other teams because Tulane was so good offensively. They were elite.
The team finished an impressive 2nd place in Conference USA behind Southern Miss, who was the league's powerhouse at the time. There was only one thing left, Tulane's return back to bowl season.
When we got the news from Coach Bowden that he turned it down, we were livid as a team because you wanted to be rewarded for the hard work that you put in. You know, it was a turnaround. You know, you added 6 games in winning in our league. And like you said, we played some pretty good talent that was out there. You want that recognition. But, you know, sometimes it takes hindsight, it takes several years. It takes becoming a parent, becoming a coach or something to that effect where you would look back on it and understand we would have never had the 98 season had we not had the 97 season.
At the time, players were caught off guard by the fact that a 7-4 season, a rare mark in Green Wave football history, would not earn the team a bowl berth after all. For many, it was almost a foregone conclusion, and losing that opportunity would actually seed what 1998 would become, as Bernard Robertson just mentioned. Ordino also remembers this moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was tough. We felt like we earned it. You know, I believe we finished 2nd in the league that year. Clearly would have got in now. You know, the other thing about now versus then is, if we did not get in for whatever reason, we would have 20 different news sources explaining to us now why we didn't get in. Back then, we didn't really know why. I still don't know why exactly, whether Tulane declined or whatever. But the bottom line is we didn't play in the bowl game, and that was very frustrating. I think it certainly fed into the next offseason where it was sort of a no-holds-barred thing. I mean, we realized, we looked around and said, this team was 7-4. The only 2 games where we weren't ultra-competitive of the 4 losses were games against very good teams, Southern Miss at their place, and then Ole Miss, who had 2 first-round picks in the backfield. They beat us kind of comfortably. But otherwise, we looked around and said, you know, this was a very competitive team. It was good, but we got everybody back. We lost a lot of good players on defense, but on offense, I think we lost Corey Geeson, a tackle, incredible player, but it was one guy. We lost the fullback, Darryl Jackson. We may have lost a couple others, but I mean, for the most part, we got everybody back intact. We had the offensive line return other than Geeson. Sean King obviously was back. TJ, Juwan, Coach Bowden had recruited well, had good guys coming in. And of course, we had Jamaican in the backfield. And then Tony Converse joined them in 98. So we had this great core of offense. It was a very good offense the year before. And we just felt like we got better as the year went on in terms of being more sophisticated, understanding what the goal was. So you looked at it, you had the bitter taste in your mouth from the bowl loss and looking forward into that offseason. Well, there's no reason that we can't make this thing much better than it was even last year. And having not continuing the drought, because the last time Tulane had been to a bowl before the Liberty Bowl in 98 was the 1987 Independence Bowl, I believe. So we had a chance to break a 10-year drought. We didn't do it. And so that was certainly motivation going into the 98 season.
So I asked Coach Bowden if he remembered why the team didn't get to play in a bowl game. This was something that was a mystery to virtually all of the players that I talked to, with several theories actually being floated. Coach Bowden did shed some light for us.
Probably one of the mistakes I think I made as a young, early head coach. I remember Sandy Barber, the athletic director, who, by the way, just I thought did a bomb job as far as support, giving me everything she could possibly give me to be successful. I remember she called me in and she said, There's a brand new bowl. They're interested in us. Would you better keep going? It's the humanitarian bowl. I said, well, Sandy, I knew he struggled a little bit financially. I knew it was going to cost us money to go. It was an expensive trip. I said, to be honest with you, we've had success. I think I can capitalize on recruiting and carry some of the momentum from the success we had and success recruiting. I discourage her from going. Whether we would have had it or not, I don't know. But I think I made a mistake because I should have had a better feel of what the team might have wanted. And I was looking at it from an overall perspective. It's going to cost us a lot of money. We don't have a lot of money. We can really get active on recruiting for a great year and capitalize on the success first year. So probably a mistake I made. Probably could have gone. That's the way it went.
So with only one option and a sense that it wasn't as valuable as the time spent recruiting, Tulane's bowl drought was set to continue into 1998. Whether intentionally or not, the 1997 team had teed up the 1998 season with one clear mission: to dominate every opponent until no one could forget about the Tulane Green Wave. Jerry Godfrey, an offensive lineman, he wonders if the Wave had been invited to a bowl game in 97, maybe that fire wouldn't have been there. Maybe the team wouldn't have performed to the same extent that it did in 1998.
There was definitely a whole lot of talk around the program and some guys and whatnot that if we won this game, if we beat Houston and see the finale, then we qualify for the bowl. And, you know, for us, at that time, the upperclassmen and so on and so forth, they had not been to a bowl game or even been even considered for a bowl game. So, I mean, it wasn't even a thought. So for us to get there at that point, we, you know, we had our minds made up and we went to Houston and whipped them pretty good. I remember telling my dad, when the game's over, today, I don't know where we're going yet, but we're going to find out this weekend about a bowl game. And if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure after it was all said and done, they called us in on Sunday and said, sorry, we're not going. I don't know if we didn't get picked. I don't know what the answer was or why we didn't go. We just didn't go. I also thought at that point in time, there was a lot of disappointment from guys, and that could have went two ways. That could have went, well, we did all this work and we got nothing out of it, or it went the way that it did go, was, with all this work, we came up short, and we're not happy just going 7-4. Because you're right, we should have won a couple more games. We did some things that didn't help us on those games, so we should have been, you know, we either could have been a nine-win season that year. Now, I can't tell you what that would do for the next year, you know, because maybe if we win nine games, maybe 98 never happens. So, you know, that's just the way it goes in sports.
That's the end of chapter one. I want to say thanks to the Tulane University Marching Band for producing our theme music. You can find them on Twitter at TulaneUBand. Give them a follow. See you all next time in Chapter 2, Covington.